Everybody, this is the fifth office hours session for the online Mises Academy class, Basics of Economics, Action and Exchange. And I'm just fielding some questions from the brave souls who decided to use part of their weekend to get more. So Kim had asked, when will the Thursday's lecture be posted? And I just wanted to explain the logistics behind that before turning to a different question. What happens is WebEx records the lectures as I give a lecture, it's recording it, and then it saves it somehow. But my understanding is before the people at the Mises Institute can post it in the forum for you guys to be able to download, they have to convert it somehow because it's the format in which it's saved from the WebEx people. It's not like something that's playable on a standard player. And so that's partly why there's always a lag for those of you who are usually watching the lectures, not live, but after they've been recorded. I think what we're going to try to, and then Kim also asked about the Obamacare course, which is going to start, does it start this week? Losing track of time here. Yeah, it starts this upcoming week. So I will blast out an email to try to get you guys to sign up if you're interested. It starts this Wednesday, the 20th. So your last lecture, live lecture for the Basics of Economics course is this Thursday, November 21st. The Obamacare class, the first one, starts the day before on the 20th. The overlap was unavoidable because with Thanksgiving and then with Christmas, and we wanted to squeeze in the Obamacare course while it was still kind of topical. There was no way to do it with that. I couldn't wait for this course you guys are in right now to end before starting the next one because then it would run the Thanksgiving week. So, but what we're going to do is I think we're going to switch to a Google Hangout format for the Obamacare class, because I think that's going to be easier. My understanding is partly why we're doing it is that we won't have this problem with the lag, where I'll give a live lecture and then it might be days before the video can get posted. I think part of why we're trying the new format is to make it so you can get it almost instantly. Kim asks, is there anything we can do to prepare for the Obamacare course? If you are signed up, we're gonna get the syllabus up. I'm just still choosing the readings and so forth. Today, we'll have that syllabus up. With all my classes, I never expect people to have read anything going into the first lecture. So you're not gonna miss out, but if you do wanna check like the day before on the course forum page, the thing that you log in through academy.mises.org, you should see the readings should be up by that point if you want to get a head start. Okay, but in the beginning, the first lecture, I'm going to basically just give a broad overview of what the legislation is, and just explain what we're going to cover in the course, because it's, as the name suggests, it's the economics of Obamacare. So we're going to have to get into some of the minutiae of the specific details of the legislation, but I also want to give like a historical overview. Why is it that health insurance, is typically provided by your employer, whereas people don't get their car insurance from their employer, they don't get their homeowner's insurance, so how come so many people get their health insurance from their employer, things like that. And then we're also going to look at what economists theoretically have said about healthcare and health insurance, because there's some heavy-duty economists like Kenneth Arrow who famously argued that the nature of health insurance is one where there are market failures. And so I'm just saying like that's the sense in which Krugman and people like that would be able to say, oh no, we can't have a free market in healthcare or healthcare insurance even, because of all these alleged market failures. And so we'll tackle that. And then I also want to get into what I think is the best argument from people who are proponents of Obamacare is when they say, you guys are crazy. You're giving us all these scare stories that people are going to be dying on the streets because of the socialized medicine. But give me a break. They have single payer in plenty of European countries, and it's not like they're all dying from heart attacks and so forth. So I want to look into that, and we'll go over what the actual situation is, and then we'll also talk about, you know, what would a free market economist say in response to claims like that. Okay, but for all that stuff, if you just go to academy.mises.org, you can see all the information about timetables and things like that. But I also, if you're enrolled in this Basics of Economics class, I'll blast out an email telling everyone about it. The other thing, too, is the follow-up course to what we're doing right now. So in other words, the middle section of Lessons for the Young Economist, we're going to start that in early January. So that, again, will be a six-week course when we go through the middle third of the book, basically. And so if you like this course, I realize it's in my interest to tell you this, but it's true. It's just going to keep getting better. And so, in other words, we needed the foundation. I hope you like this stuff that we're doing, but we get into the real meat of economics as opposed to the foundational, you know, what is economics? Well, we start using it more in the middle third, where we go through the nature of a market economy. Okay, so anyway, that's going to start. I don't think that's officially on the Mises Academy page yet, because we're still, you know, we still got to pick the actual day of the week and the time and stuff, but it's going to start in January, not the first week, because we have more people travel for New Year's and stuff, but maybe the next one. Oh, it is up there, apparently. Andrew says it is. Okay, great. So I'll blast that out, too, for people. Okay, let's see. Mike says, I believe that property ownership is necessary for resource allocation, but I am not completely sold on Lockean property rights theory. Do you have any other ideas about how to establish property ownership? Okay, that's a good question. Well, I'm assuming, Mike, that you don't just mean the way John Locke himself wrote about it. You mean in general, like the way Rothbard and Ethics of Liberty would have used the homesteading principle. Well, let me talk about that, and then Mike, you can say more if you want to clarify what your concern is. But for the benefit of people who don't really know what we're talking about, I'll say some general introductory remarks first. So John Locke is famous, among other things, for the theory of mixing your labor with something to make it yours. Let me see, I'm trying to look up the exact quote. So it's in the Second Treatise of Government. And let's see, from chapter 5, whatsoever then he removes out of the state that nature hath provided and left it in, he hath mixed his labor with and joined it to something that is his own. And that's, I was quoting there from his Second Treatise. And that's the way John Locke tried to explain how is it that people come to own things. That if you think about it, you know, way back in the day, there must have been people and nobody owned anything. And so then how do you get to a situation where the physical things out there in the world are owned by people? And so he's saying, well, let's say I own my labor, okay, that seems like a natural default position. And then if there's something that was unowned that nobody else has any claim over, and I come up and I somehow mix my labor with it, I just homesteaded it, and now it's mine. So you stumble upon some virgin forest land, and it's clear that no human being has ever been here, or at least you see no evidence that a human being is here. and then you start taking the, you knock down some of the trees and you build a fence around a portion of it, you build a house on it, you start planting vegetables, and then maybe you capture some wild animals that are roaming around and domesticate them, blah, blah, blah. Okay. The point is that's yours because it wasn't anybody else's. And then who else is it going to be? So that's what Locke did. And then Murray Rothbard and Hans Hoppe, I think, are the libertarian theorists who have elaborated on that the most in their own work. And they call it the homesteading principle. And so in terms of libertarian theory, usually we just, in day-to-day applications of it, we just kind of start out with the idea that people own stuff. And then you got to, or what libertarianism says is everything has to be voluntary unless the person is a criminal. So long as somebody doesn't initiate aggression against anybody else, we have no business messing with that person's property. That anytime we want to have access to that person's property, it's got to be consensual. So the problem, though, is we'll turn back the clock. How do we figure out what is rightfully owned by people? Because it's all fine and good to say right now going forward, everything needs to be consensual, voluntary transactions. But what if people right now disagree about who owns what? So like, what if Native Americans say, what the heck are you doing? We actually own all this land that our ancestors lived here. And then the white man came and, you know, used guns and tuberculosis or whatever to get rid of us and push us off the land. So don't tell me that, oh, because you're a libertarian, that means I have to pay you to be able to live in this apartment building. The very ground on which the apartment building is standing was stolen from my great, great, great grandfather or whatever it is. Okay. So to fully ground libertarian theory, you need to explain how do things go from being in a state of nature to being owned. And that's where the homesteading principle comes in. So there's two main problems with that I'll talk about. And Mike, let me know if you if this is the kind of stuff that bothers you or if you have different concerns. And again, for anyone else who's tuned in here, you don't have to wait till I'm talking about it. If you want to ask something else, go ahead and I'll just adjust how long I spend on Mike's question. So the two main lines of attack I've seen on this, one is just a historical one to say, you know, yeah, for in terms of internal logical consistency, it's necessary for Rothbard or Hoppe to have a mechanism by which people could have appropriated the raw gifts of nature when they were unowned to become owned by people. So then you can explain how it's conceivable we could have had a voluntary society from day one. But in practice, we know that isn't what happened, so who cares? In other words, what's the point of giving this baseline demonstration where people could discover some virgin unowned land, mix their labor with it, blah, blah, blah. Now it's theirs. And then from that point forward, when they interact with people, as long as the title to that was transacted voluntarily, we have this great libertarian world. So what? What's the point of going through those arguments when we know that history is full of conquest and that it seems like that's a nice story to tell, but what's the point of that? How does that affect what we do right now? Because there almost is nothing that exists right now whose origin was not at some point in the past tainted by aggression. All right, so that's, I've seen that line of argument used against the standard libertarian embrace of homesteading theory. Then I've also, and so that would come from, I mean, a lot of people might say something like that, but I've seen it. I think Kevin Carson talks about that a lot. And he thinks it's very naive when modern libertarians, a lot of times, yeah, they might object to Halliburton, or they might object to pharmaceutical companies that relying on patents or something and illegal rules preventing the reimportation of drugs and stuff like that. But he thinks modern libertarians still have this prima facie default where they think the current distribution of property titles is basically okay. And that most of what happens if it were voluntary with respect to these existing distribution of property titles would be just, when he thinks, no, systematically, workers have been getting screwed over the ages by the rich. First it was the feudal barons, and then now it's the capitalist, or it was the robber barons, so-called, later on, and then now it's the bankers, or whatever you want to call them, whatever group and label you want to give to it. But he's saying history has just been one episode after another where the powerful rich people trample on the rights of everybody else and steal their property and then bribe the government to enforce rules in their favor. And so why is it that libertarians get so passionate about property rights and the rule of law and blah, blah, blah? Come on, this is all a big farce. Okay, so that's, I'm exaggerating perhaps, but that's the line that I took from Kevin Carson. David Friedman had a different approach, and he was just taking it on purely theoretical thought experiment grounds and saying he thought that the homesteading principle had some serious problems and that it might be a nice rule of thumb in an everyday conversation, but it clearly it wasn't scientifically rigorous. And so he would say stuff like, or he has said stuff like, okay, well, let's say I'm the first human being to ever get to the coastline and there's the ocean out in front of me. And I take a glass of milk and I dump it in the ocean. Well, eventually all that milk is going to diffuse and spread out over the ocean in some sense. And so did I just now claim ownership of the whole ocean or all the oceans on Earth? Because ultimately, though, those bodies of water are interconnected. And most people would probably say no. But then, you know, once you agree with that, then it's tricky. What does it mean to mix your labor with something to establish ownership? And incidentally, it's not like Rothbard and Hoppe never thought of this stuff. I mean, they had those concerns too. It's just Friedman thinks they didn't adequately solve them. Okay, so, or another thing, the first one, let's say you buy the standard story of the moon landing, because I know a lot of libertarians don't, so I'm not taking sides. I'm just acknowledging some people don't think it happened. But let's say the standard story is correct. When Neil Armstrong is the first human being to land on the moon and plants the U.S. flag, what does that mean? Does that mean that NASA or somebody owns what? That plot of land as far as Neil Armstrong could see with his eyes? Or does he own the whole moon? And, you know, and you can get into issues with, well, NASA's a government funded, but suppose it were a privately funded venture. I don't, you know, let's not bring in the government aspect of it. The point is, the first human being to land on the moon mark his or her presence by planting a flag or something. Surely homesteading theory says they have now some sort of claim over that that's stronger than other people's claims. Because that's incidentally what that's kind of the way that Hoppe develops it. They say, well, Rothbard as well. As you may know, Hoppe has an argumentations ethics defense of self-ownership to explain why is it that you own your body as the default position. And that was an extension that Rothbard endorsed. But in terms of where does the homesteading principle come from, I think one of the arguments they use is to say, well, somebody has to own it, right? There's various possibilities, and we're going to assume that a standard uniform theory of rights has to apply to everybody. So one possibility is nobody owns anything. That doesn't work. Another possibility is everybody owns everything, meaning like there's a collective that owns everything, and that doesn't work, and socialism doesn't work. And so clearly there has to be some kind of rule that assigns ownership of specific things to specific individuals, but not to everybody else. And so doesn't it seem kind of natural that if I'm the first person to get my hands on something, that that thing should be mine and not somebody else's? Because we have to have some rule to get it to be owned, otherwise it can't be usefully incorporated into the economy. So using that logic, it does seem that the first person who would land on the moon and somehow transforms the moon with his labor is claiming ownership of something, but what? And like I said, it's not obvious. And it's like, again, because you in principle, you could say, what is it, the whole, even if you thought it was the whole surface of the moon, well, does that mean, what if people drill down? What if there's mineral deposits a mile beneath the surface of the moon? The first person who lands on top of the moon, does he or she have rights to all that as well? Okay, so it gets really complicated, or even just on Earth. The first person that stumbles into a forest and claims a certain area, let's say there's a stream going through the plot of land. So clearly, intuitively, we want to say, if somebody builds a fence around the area, builds a house on it, plants a garden, and this was previously completely virgin territory that no human being had ever set foot upon, you want to say that, okay, come on, that's person's land. He homesteaded it. Okay, but suppose there's a stream with trout that goes right through that plot of land, right? So the boundaries of this person's land, you know, the stream comes in on the north end and the stream leaves on the south end, let's say. And so the person in his mind every day goes to the stream and puts his net in there and catches some fish. And in his mind, well, of course, this stream's on my property. How could I not have the right to the fish that are swimming through my yard? But if there's somebody 3 miles downstream and that person has done the exact same setup down there, well, that person now could understandably get upset if the person 3 miles upstream starts fishing so heavily that now no trout ever show up down there. That person's gonna might argue, hey, you're stealing my fish. Okay, so it gets really complicated. Or if they both start drilling down, and what if there's a pool of oil that's located beneath both of their properties, such that if one person starts, you know, puts a well on his land and starts pumping oil that way, thinking, you know, I'm building this well right smack dab in the middle of my property. Of course I have the right to do that. And oil comes up. Of course that's my oil and I can go sell it. But what if by doing that, he's draining the basin or the reservoir that's actually, if you saw a map, like a, you know, a, what do you call that? I want to say a contour map, but I don't think that's the word I want to use. A map showing the surface of the ground and the depths of it with the pool of oil, you know, here's the two guys' land, and then the pool of oil is in the middle, and so they're kind of draining. And so if one person pumps more barrels of oil, that means the other person has less. Right? So you get into stuff like that, or they invent airplanes, and now planes are flying overhead. So what does that mean? Can you, when you build a fence around land in your forest, you clearly own the grass and the surface area, but do you own a column of property that goes up to the upper atmosphere? And so a plane needs to get your permission before it flies over you. See, so it's, these are the kind of things that David Friedman was taking and pushing to the extreme. So it's, and the general principle was what seems to be a very logical, reasonable, intuitive principle in a certain setting, it looks like it's hard to apply in other situations. So my general answer for that, Mike, is I don't actually think that I don't think we can, as theorists, just sit down in our armchair and think out and deduce the entire body of law that would apply to a free society. I think that's what judges are for in case law. And so you'd have a competing system of judges, private judges, who don't have jurisdiction over people. They just have expertise in various areas of the law. And then when there's a dispute, so the person who's downstream from the upstream person says, hey, you can't be fishing so much because that's hurting, you know, I don't have any fish. What the heck? And so he brings a lawsuit against the person who lives upstream. They go and find a judge that they both agree on to render an opinion on the case. And then that's what happens. And then if the one person thinks the opinion's terrible, he can try to take it to a different judge and try to overturn the verdict and so on. And so that's the way a competitive market and judicial rulings would work. And I don't want to go into that too deeply right now, but that's the way I see it happening. And so there would be a role in such a world for legal theorists. So people like Murray Rothbard could write things like his book, The Ethics of Liberty, and lay out a prescription for this is the way I think the law should unfold in a free society. And maybe judges would be influenced by that. And maybe they would even advertise and say, hey, I'm a Rothbardian when it comes to my views on judicial philosophy or legal theory, or I don't know what term they would use. And that's entirely possible, but I think the way the law works, it's sort of like the common law tradition as it was in England, where a lot of it is built upon case law and precedent. And so in that sense, it's what a Hayekian would call a spontaneous order as well. It's that there's so many odd circumstances and little applications that you can't centrally plan the whole legal system. Okay, so Mike, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I guess what I'm saying is just like if somebody said to me, hey, how could a free market in healthcare work? And we're going to touch upon that in the Obamacare class, obviously. I could certainly paint general principle or paint a big picture using principles of the market economy and give examples of how I think certain things would be better. But part of the rationale for relying on decentralized markets is I don't have all the answers. We would leave it up to other entrepreneurs to come up with new ways of dealing with certain types of sicknesses, or to come up with a way to allow poor people to pay for services, or whatever the issue is. And so it's the same kind of thing in the area of law, that I can certainly explain why the government monopoly right now leads to all sorts of weird outcomes and things that most people would agree are not just, but to then say, okay, well then how would your system work? It's actually it wouldn't make sense for me to explain, oh, this is exactly how we would ground property right ownership in a libertarian world. That's partly what I would leave it to the legal theorists and the judges in practice in a voluntary setting to help codify and elaborate. Okay, let's see. Kim Alexander says, why do Marxists believe it is evil for capitalists to steal our labor, but we have a moral obligation to give it over to the collective? Okay, that's a good question. The reason I'm pausing here, Kim, is because I'm trying to remember if I've ever seen a Marxist actually talk about that. Well, let me just make sure people understand the first part. So the Marxists adopt a labor theory of value. And so they think, and remember, that's not a Marxist invention, that Adam Smith and David Ricardo and John Stuart Mill and I think even J.B. Say and Frederick Bastiat all had versions of a labor theory of value. By which I mean they thought when you're theoretically as an economist trying to explain the market price of something, why is it that some goods in the marketplace trade for 10 times a piece of coal, but other ones only trade for 2 times a piece of coal or whatever, to explain those different exchange ratios, they thought it ultimately was due to how much labor was embedded in those various goods, that the labor was the source of the value. So when it came to interest, and how was it that there was this group of people called the capitalists that earned an interest income, the way a Marxist would look at that is to say, wait a minute, clearly the workers are the ones who are generating all of the output in society. And it just so happens, because of the state of our technological relations and material forces of production, whatever phrase you want to use, the workers are able, there's a surplus. The workers are able to physically produce more stuff than they need themselves to regenerate their labor power. And so that's why there is this surplus. And that is what the capitalists skim off the top, or at least they skim off some component of it. So that's how it's physically possible. In other words, I mean, just think about it in terms of food. If there is to be like a master-slave relationship or a exploiter-exploited relationship, that's only physically possible if food were the only thing that was produced. The people actually growing the food and picking the crops or whatever, they need to pick more food or gather more food than they need to eat themselves just to stay alive and to replenish their strength to be able to go out in the field again the next day, because otherwise it wouldn't work. All right. So the Marxists think that that's true in general. And so they see this gap between what the workers actually get themselves. In other words, the pay the workers get for their labor is not enough to go out in the marketplace and actually buy what it should be able to, given that everything in the marketplace is priced according to how much labor is in it. All right, I don't know if that made sense, but so everything that's in the marketplace, its actual price is reflects how much labor power went into it. So if the workers were actually paid the full value of their labor power, that they would be able to go out in the marketplace and buy up everything, and there wouldn't be anything left over for the capitalists, because the capitalists haven't actually put any labor into it. They just sit back. They finance projects with their money, but they don't actually lift a finger and physically help make anything. And so if it's true that the value of everything in the marketplace reflects how much labor went into it, the only way to square all that stuff is to say the capitalists, when they hire workers to go to the factory and labor for them, they're underpaying them. They're actually not paying them wages commensurate with the full amount of market value that the workers are imputing into the products, because they can't be, because the capitalists, we know, end up when the capitalists take the product and go sell it in the marketplace, they get paid from consumers in accordance with how much labor power is in that stuff. So if they go out and sell everything for $100, that meant there was $100 worth of labor power. But for the capitalists to have any profit, they can't be paying the $100 back to the workers. Maybe they're only paying them $95. And then the capitalist keeps $5 in profit. And so that's the sense in which the Marxist says the very existence of profit means the capitalists, almost by definition or by accounting, are underpaying the workers. Okay, so, and also, I mean, it was a little more sophisticated when you bring into account capital goods and things like that. So if there's a factory owner and the workers come in and use all sorts of complicated tools and use raw materials that were or semi-finished goods that were bought from some other company. So there's a factory that makes automobiles. And the factory owner already had the assembly line in place, and then there's electricity running it, and there's tires that come in from some other tire seller, and there's engine parts that come in from some other manufacturer and all these things. And he hires workers to come in and just assemble things on the assembly line so that the finished vehicle pops out the end. The march just isn't saying the factory owner should take all the revenue from selling those vehicles and give it to the workers in his factory. No, because clearly other people are involved in the creation of those cars. But the point is, like, what he, the factory owner, had to pay for the tires that he bought from somebody else reflects how much labor power is in those tires. And so the point is, if a capitalist were to pay everything, including the full value of the labor product from his laborers, then he would be left with nothing. And so at various stages, anytime the capitalists are involved and there's somebody in there who's earning a rate of return on his financial capital, his investment of money in a project, then the Marxists are saying that means the workers aren't getting paid the full value, because the capitalist there is siphoning away some of that revenue, when in fact all the revenue from products in the market reflect labor power. Just as an perhaps interesting aside, Bombavirk just obliterated that, and that was the Marxist, what's called the problem of surplus value, because if that's true, if the Marxist theory of interest, because back in the day they kind of used the terms profit and interest interchangeably. So when a Marxist talked about profit, he meant accounting profit in the sense revenues being higher than monetary expenses. Okay. So Bombavirk pointed out, if that theory is true, then industries that have more labor relative to capital equipment, things that are more labor intensive, should have a higher rate of return on invested capital, right? Because remember what I just said, if you're the factory owner and you're selling making cars, and you sell the cars for whatever, $20,000, and then only $2,000 of that goes to the workers you hire to come in and assemble the pieces, and the rest of it goes to paying the utility company for the electricity, you got to pay a lot for the engine parts, and you pay a lot for the tires, and you pay a lot for whatever, then there's not the only part that you, that particular factory owner, are skimming off is the relatively small contribution of the laborers who came into your factory and assembled the pieces. You are paying the full value of the labor embedded in everything else that you bought in the wholesale market. It's the other people that were ripping off those workers. Okay, so Bombavirk pointed out that if that Marxist theory of exploitation was correct, a factory owner where most of what goes into his finished product is hiring workers should be, you know, earning a hot more, skimming more off the top for every $100 of revenue than somebody who like runs an oil refinery or an oil rig out in the deeps in the ocean somewhere, where most of his expenses are not from workers. Most of his expenses are for really heavy duty capital equipment and stuff like that, because he's not able to skim off the top because there's no workers that he's able to exploit. All right. So that was, but empirically, of course, that's not the case. The rate of return in labor intensive as well as capital intensive industries is roughly the same. Or at least it's based on the risk. It's not based on how many workers you're able to exploit. So that was one of the huge internal problems with the Marxist logic. But back to your example, Kim, or your question. So if the Marxists have this view that the workers are systematically exploited under capitalism, why would they think they wouldn't be exploited under socialism? Well, I think part of it is just what I just said, that they thought the natural outcome, so long as we got rid of those capitalist exploiters, would be that the workers would earn the full value, the full product of their labor. And so that they wouldn't, nobody would be stealing from them. And if you're saying, well, but in a socialist system where the government runs everything, isn't there a sense in which the government takes from everybody and then gives back? I think there's two possible things they would say. One is that when we say that the capitalists are exploiting the workers, we're talking about what they actually end up with economically in terms of the way the system works. So they're not focusing narrowly on, because actually the capitalists do not own the workers. They're not literally slaves. The workers in principle have the right to say, no, I don't want to work at this factory. And so the workers do own their labor. But where the exploitation comes in is to see, in practice, according to the Marxists, the workers get paid wages that are systematically below what the actual value is of the product they're creating. And so if under socialism that's not true, that what the workers in practice get to consume is equal to the full value of their labor because they're not there's no capitalist exploiter anymore, then they're going to say that's the sense in which we're not stealing from them. But then also, the Marxists did think that, yeah, there's the transition phase where we're going to have the proletariat violently overthrow the current bourgeois structure, but that gradually the state withers away. And so I'm not an expert in Marxism, so I don't know exactly how they would deal with your question, but I think they would say at worst, we're just going to have this transition phase where, yeah, the violent apparatus of the state is going to be ordering people around and telling them where to work, but eventually that will all wither away. It'll just be everybody will be working, like people will want to work for the collective because they will live to work, not work to live. And that the productivity of their labor is going to be so high that it's not going to seem like a chore. And so if we need people over here because we need more doctors, well, then people will naturally go into that because why wouldn't you want to help your fellow person that you sick, you know, that kind of stuff. Naturally, I'm not endorsing that system. I'm just telling you, I think that's kind of how they would deal with it. Okay, Mike says, I would imagine that an effective manner in which to establish property ownership could arise in a free market system of competing resolution firms based on its effectiveness versus ineffective methods. Right. With a lot of this stuff, it would partly reflect what people's own value system was, or what their own views as to proper property titles were. So I think it's entirely possible, perhaps even likely, that what we call an anarcho-capitalist environment or framework would yield different types of property laws in one area with, you know, one type of culture versus another. And that, is that good or bad? I don't know. But I think that's what would happen. Just like if you had an anarcho-capitalist society where the people were 99% of the people were vegetarians, the grocery stores and the system of agriculture and what have you would look one way. And if you had another place where 99% of the people really love to eat steak and hamburger and so on, it would look a different way. And so if you have a market for law and people have much, you know, vastly different preferences as to what they think a just society looks like, then I think we need to accept that the market would cater to those preferences. And so it's, you know, if you had a society where 99% of the people really thought it was an abominable crime to disrespect your parents, I think competing defense agencies and private judges and whatever in that kind of a setting, it would be illegal to disrespect your parents to find some appropriate way. Now, what would, you know, at first people say, well, wait a minute, I don't know, sign up for that. But again, as with everything, when you're arguing about anarchy versus statism, it's always an apples to apples, or it should be an apples to apples comparison. That if that kind of outcome horrifies you, well, you don't, really what horrifies you is that there could be a concentration of people where 99% of them thought it should be a crime to disrespect the parents. It's not the anarchism that's giving the result, it's the fact that by assumption I'm saying, imagine there's people that think that way, and they really strongly believe it. So you don't make the situation better by having a state. If those people formed a state, well, then that rule is clearly going to be enforced, and very harshly. And so, you know, maybe somebody who disrespects his parents gets executed or gets his hand chopped off or something. Whereas at least if it's in a voluntary setting where it's a market outcome, then I would imagine those positions would moderate over time as people were actually bearing the costs of the situation. So maybe a different example that would be easier for us to grasp is something like cocaine being illegal. That if you had a society where 99% of the population thought it should be an actual crime to sell cocaine, then I think the night after the conversion, everyone sees the light when it comes to not initiating aggression, but yet they define aggression to be selling cocaine. You see what I'm saying? That what if they agreed with the Rothbardian principle? It's just they thought that guy Murray Rothbard had a blind spot when it came to the aggression of getting someone hooked on cocaine, because that really ruined your life. And so somebody who would sell you cocaine is effectively aggressing against you. Just suppose people thought that. It would still be better if that kind of outcome alarms you. It would still be better for that society to be anarcho-capitalist and have those non-libertarian laws on the books, because I think over time it would get moderated pretty quickly. Whereas if it were enforced by the state, the only way it would get reformed is if through a democratic election, people voted for it. Whereas in the other way around, you know, so put it this way, to be locking up people, okay, so if you have truly a non-violent cocaine dealer, I mean, somehow there's got to be a way to keep him in prison. And after a while, I think people would, when push came to shove, so you're a guy who owns an apartment building, and there's someone who wants to rent from you, and you know you could rent the apartment for $500 to this guy, you know, to the general public, or there's a convicted cocaine dealer who's willing to pay you $700 a month. So is it really worth $200 a month to adhere to your conviction, you know, your inner moral principles, or are you going to say, well, the only thing he ever did was sell cocaine to people who voluntarily wanted it. It's not like he used any force against anybody. Yeah, okay, maybe else. So the point is, I think people's black and white views as to who's a criminal or not would get moderated pretty quickly in practice, and that views would become much more tolerant if people had to actually bear the cost of enforcing what they originally thought were their really stern convictions. Whereas if the guy is a serial killer, and you own an apartment building, no, you're not going to let him rent an apartment from you, even if he paid more than somebody else, because he's a serial killer. You see the difference there? So, but if that same apartment owner is just voting in an election and one politician says, I'm tough on crime and I'm going to lock up these drug dealers, Well, that's not an extra $200 a month out of that voter's pocket, one way or the other. That's just the government's going to pay for it, and that particular voter doesn't really see the economic costs of incarcerating nonviolent drug sellers. So that's, I guess those are my thoughts on that. Just be careful. And it's here I'm relying a lot on David Friedman's analysis of this stuff. And in the beginning, I rejected it. I didn't like it because I didn't like what the answer was. But as the years passed, I think he's right that you have to put aside your own personal value system if you're just going to be an economist. So I might, for example, I don't like heroin, and I think the world would be a better place if nobody ever used heroin. But as an economist, I could certainly analyze markets and say what would happen if the government lifted the ban on heroin production and consumption and sales tomorrow, and there would be a market for heroin. And even though I don't like that, I can see how it would be better to not try to ban it than it would be the other way around. So by the same token, there's lots of stuff. I don't think it really helps anything in almost any situation to take someone and put them in a cage. Whereas there's a lot of people that think, well, no, if you're a criminal and you did something, we got to punish you and grab you and put you in a cage. And they think that that's justice. And I personally disagree with that in most cases. And don't think that retribution is the way to get to a healthier society. But the point is, I think, so, but I have to acknowledge that that's what people's preferences are, and that if the government no longer prohibited competitive markets in law enforcement and imprisonment, and blah, 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 that I think the spontaneous order that emerged, there would be legal rulings and penalties meted out that I personally would think would be too harsh. But the market would quickly go to work on that. And I think would moderate those outcomes, whereas with the state doing it, people aren't made to bear the cost of it. Another example would be something like racism and discrimination. Gary Becker has a famous article on that, and others have elaborated on it. That, yeah, in a purely free market, a restaurant owner would have the legal freedom to say only white people can come into my restaurant. But and if the society were sufficiently racist, that could be the profitable thing to do. And that horrifies a lot of people, but I think the best way to, if you don't like those views, the best way to get rid of them and minimize them is not to run to the government and have it try to enforce it. Because if you think about it, the kind of society where enough people are racist that it would be profitable for a restaurant to have that policy, why, if we all of a sudden use majority rule, are those people going to vote for politicians who punish them for their own views? That doesn't make any sense. And we can see in many places historically what governments did do to racial minorities. And so I think voluntary interactions is always a preferable way, whatever the original situation is. It's not going to get you something that everybody likes up front. It's impossible because people have different views about what an ideal world would look like. So no social system is going to make everybody happy on day one because we have incompatible visions. But I think a lot of what's wrong with the present social system, and people blame it on markets or greed or whatever, is actually because of coercive government monopoly. So if you got rid of that, we would see that our visions are not so distinct. Okay, Mike says, aren't Friedman's theories falsifiable? Oh, he's joking. Yeah, Mike's making a reference to David Friedman and I had a debate at with the Porcupine Freedom Festival, or what's called Pork Fest, over the summer. focusing on economic method. And so that's what Mike's making a joke about. Okay, I guess we can stop there. The hour's about up. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. And I will send out an email with all the information about the upcoming classes. And I'm also going to post your quiz 5 today.